individuo entra en contacto por segunda vez con el agente extraño. Poco después es Pasteur quien analiza la importancia de las características de los agentes extraños, o llamados de otra manera antígenos, y da el gran paso en la profilaxis a través de sus vacunas con gérmenes atenuados. A finales del siglo XVIII, gracias a los trabajos de von Behring y Kitasato, se logra comprender el significado de estas observaciones y aparece con la descripción de la antitoxina diftérica el concepto de anticuerpo que, unido a los descubrimientos de la alexina, hoy conocido como complemento de Büchner y Bordet, completa los primeros conceptos que se tienen de respuesta inmune humoral. A finales del 19, Metnikoff introduce el concepto de fagocitosis o de la acción directa de ciertas células en la defensa del organismo, lo que de alguna manera abre una discusión entre los defensores de las teorías humorales y de los defensores de las teorías celulares como mecanismos de defensa. Otro inglés, Wright, intenta unir ambas y describe las opsoninas, anticuerpos que favorecen la fagocitosis, con lo que de alguna forma se inician las teorías unitarias que hasta nuestros días dan explicación y motivo de discusión de los mecanismos de la respuesta inmune. Son predecesores de los trabajos del profesor Porter los conceptos de especificidad del anticuerpo descrito por la Steiner, las primeras descripciones de Ehrlich sobre las reacciones antígeno-anticuerpo como auténtico fenómeno químico, los conceptos de anafilaxia de Cook y Freeman, los de autoinmunidad de Witteveen y Coombs, los trabajos de Medawar describiendo el rechazo de tejidos como fenómeno inmunológico y, finalmente, la teoría sobre selección clonal de Burnett. Es justamente a mediados de nuestro siglo cuando el profesor Porter comienza su trabajo y aporta las bases moleculares al concepto de anticuerpo, describiendo su estructura y actividades. El profesor Porter, educado en la Universidad de Liverpool, obtuvo su doctorado en 1948 por la Universidad de Cambridge, habiendo trabajado con el profesor Sanger, con quien se inicia en los análisis estructurales de las proteínas. Desde 1949 colabora con el profesor Martin en el Mill Hill de Londres, en el National Institute for Medical Research, hasta que en 1960 es nombrado profesor en St. Mary Hospital Medical School de Londres, siendo el primer catedrático de inmunología que se nombra en el Reino Unido. En 1967 es nombrado profesor de la Universidad de Oxford y pocos años más tarde, en 1972, se le concede el Premio Nobel en Medicina compartido con su colega americano Edelman. Es miembro de diferentes academias americanas y europeas de bioquímica e inmunología, consejero del Instituto de Inmunología de Basilea desde 1973 y estando en posesión de diferentes medallas y premios de las más prestigiosas instituciones, el profesor Porter ha contribuido con más de 100 trabajos publicados al conocimiento de las actividades biológicas de los anticuerpos y del sistema del complemento a través del análisis estructural de los mismos. Con sus aportaciones y las de sus colegas en el campo de la inmunología, esta se ha visto rápidamente impulsada, pudiéndose resumir los conceptos actuales del sistema inmunológico de la siguiente forma. Este sistema tiene como principal función la defensa del organismo de la agresión de cualquier agente extraño, lo que se llama antígenos, y lo realiza tratando de destruirlos o inactivándolos con la producción de agentes defensores, bien a nivel humoral los anticuerpos, de los que ha dedicado su vida el profesor Porter, bien a nivel celular, por medio de linfocitos citotóxicos. Naturalmente, la base del sistema es que sea capaz de distinguir las sustancias ajenas de las propias. Esto es lo que se llama reconocimiento antigénico, y sus principales características son la especificidad y la memoria. Como la función del sistema inmunológico se basa en la agresión de lo ajeno o extraño al organismo, el sistema requiere un fino mecanismo de reconocimiento a nivel de membranas celulares para garantizar la propia identidad del individuo. Este mecanismo de reconocimiento lo ejerce mayoritariamente a través de receptores, a modo de antenas, que poseen sus células competentes, es decir, los linfocitos B, los linfocitos T y los macrófagos. Estos receptores son esencialmente de dos tipos, las inmunoglobulinas de membrana, de idénticas características en términos generales a los anticuerpos circulantes, y los antígenos HLA en el hombre o H2 en el ratón, codificados por el sistema principal de histocompatibilidad, que se ubica en un cromosoma independiente del que codifica para las inmunoglobulinas. Finalmente, el sistema inmunológico, para realizar su función, requiere unos mecanismos de interacción entre células B, T y macrófagos que favorezcan la respuesta al estímulo antigénico y que lo controlen, unas veces impulsándola e incrementándola y otras veces frenándolo o anulándola, lo que hace a través de los linfocitos llamados facilitadores y supresores y de una batería de factores liberados por las células correspondientes. Al igual que los anticuerpos y el complemento son potentes agentes antibacterianos, los linfocitos T son potentes agentes de defensa contra virus o contra la implantación de células con características extrañas al organismo, sean células tumorales, células parasitadas o incluso células trasplantadas de otro individuo. Sin embargo, en toda respuesta inmune juegan un papel todos los agentes mencionados, aunque con mayor o menor intensidad. Históricamente, la inmunología se benefició del adelanto de los conocimientos que se obtuvieron a nivel bacteriológico, y aún durante la Segunda Guerra Mundial, el fantasma de las epidemias neumocócicas permitió a Heidelberg profundizar en los conceptos inmunológicos de antigenicidad. Pero al mismo tiempo, también esta ciencia ha permitido una mejor comprensión de la fisiopatología de ciertas enfermedades, sean las enfermedades atópicas como la alergia, sean las autoinmunes como enfermedades endocrinológicas, reumáticas, etcétera, sean las enfermedades tumorales o sea la terapéutica a través de los trasplantes de órganos. Y de la misma manera ha influido enormemente en otros muchos temas de la biología, como son la genética, la bioquímica, la antropología, etc. La inmunología tiene planteadas aún muchas incógnitas, especialmente en el capítulo de la generación de diversidad de los anticuerpos, en donde espera lograr su respuesta a través de los estudios de hibridación y secuenciación del DNA que codifica para las inmunoglobulinas y para los antígenos de histocompatibilidad, y también en los mecanismos de interacción celular que originan la referida respuesta inmune. La posibilidad de entender los mecanismos inductores de tolerancia o de controlar los fenómenos de supresión de la respuesta inmune a través de factores, anticuerpos, antidiotipo, etc., o la aplicación de los anticuerpos monoclonales, por poner un ejemplo, como nuevas vías terapéuticas, significan grandes retos que permitirán nuevos avances en el tratamiento de las enfermedades tumorales, autoinmunes o en el éxito de los trasplantes de órganos. En este contexto, la obra del profesor Porter ha aportado un detallado análisis a nivel molecular de uno de los principales agentes inmunológicos, es decir, los anticuerpos. Primero, mediante fraccionamiento cromatográfico y más adelante con tratamientos enzimáticos muy concretos, pudo realizar la separación y el aislamiento de diferentes fragmentos de la gamma globulina y mediante análisis de los péptidos integrantes de sus cadenas y por secuenciación de los aminoácidos de los extremos amino y carboxi terminales, logré definir la estructura y configuración de los anticuerpos y, lo que es más importante, definió las funciones de cada fragmento, los mecanismos de unión específica al antígeno, el metabolismo de los mismos, su transmisión en el desarrollo fetal y otras muchas características. Con sus trabajos se pudo describir la heterogeneidad molecular de los anticuerpos integrados por clases, subclases y tipos, reconociéndose las identidades reactivas a la vez que las disparidades individuales y permitiéndole establecer las relaciones entre la estructura molecular y la genética de los anticuerpos. El profesor Porter más tarde se ha dedicado al aislamiento y caracterización de diferentes componentes del sistema del complemento y a los mecanismos de activación del mismo por agregados de inmunoglobulinas o por inmunocomplejos. Y con ello, de alguna forma, completaba el estudio de los mecanismos de acción de los anticuerpos, pues es sabido que el complemento es un sistema final de defensa activo para la acción de los anticuerpos. Estas valiosas aportaciones, brevemente enunciadas, han supuesto un pilar fundamental en el desarrollo científico de la inmunología, y gracias a los trabajos del profesor Porter, ya no existen inmunólogos en cis y en trans, como en 1962 Neil Gerne propuso, sino que las bases moleculares de la respuesta inmune han sido fundamentales en el desarrollo de la inmunogenética y de la inmunidad celular, y en consecuencia, gracias a ellos, a los trabajos del profesor Porter, hoy podemos entender la fenomenología de la respuesta inmune de una manera integrada. Yo espero que un ejemplo de lo mencionado hasta ahora sea la conferencia que el profesor Porter nos va a dar sobre inmunidad en las enfermedades infecciosas. Muchas gracias. Profesor Porter.
Yes. Right. Good. Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me here. I'm very pleased to be in Madrid, the first opportunity I've had to speak here. So it's a great pleasure and honor for me to be at the Joan March Foundation. Well, I'm going to expand, as the introductor, Professor Kreisler, has mentioned, on the molecular basis of immunity. And I'm going to do it in as straightforward a manner as I can, but I'd just like to start off by reminding you that the study of immunity really is of great practical value. It has, over the last 40 years or more, has eliminated, almost entirely eliminated, infectious diseases in temperate countries. The diphtheria and tetanus and tuberculosis, smallpox, all these things have gone. People here will hardly know what they mean by them. I'd just like to show you on the first slide that it really was a great achievement which shouldn't be forgotten. Could I have the first slide, please? This is England and Wales and the incidence of diphtheria during the century. And you can see that between 50 and 60,000 cases a year were occurring. It was common. Everybody knew about children who caught diphtheria. And when immunization was introduced, the beginning of the war became easily obtainable, then the incidence of the disease fell right down. And in fact, on Saturday, before I left the country, I noticed in the newspaper that it said there was a case of diphtheria had been suspected. When it becomes news in the paper that you get one case of a disease, it's pretty clear evidence that it has been effectually removed entirely. 40 years ago, it would have been so commonplace, nobody would have bothered to mention it. And the same thing happened with poliomyelitis. In the next slide, please. Next slide, please. Can I tap this button? This was a viral disease, and it was brought home by soldiers coming from the Far East at the end of the war, and it became epidemic in England, and of course it was a disastrous disease in that there are still many people in England and the rest of Europe who are crippled from the infections of that time. But the introduction of the vaccine here, and again, it was entirely eliminated. So that same kind of pattern could be shown for tetanus, measles, tuberculosis, mumps, whooping cough, whole series of infections which caused many deaths before immunization was brought in. But the greatest achievement, of course, has been the elimination of smallpox from the world. This was an organization of the due to the organization of the World Health Organization. And the next slide just shows a picture of the cover of their magazine. This is the World Health Organization magazine about what 2 years ago when they had the globe with this smallpox is dead across it. It's the first time in history that a disease has been eliminated. It's a fortunate case in that there are no other carriers. It isn't found in animals, but it was a great achievement. And even as late as 1970, it's been estimated that there were millions of people dying at that time. And by 1979, there were none, and there have been none since. So immunization is probably one of the most powerful and effective successes in medical research. It has a long history, as our Dr. Kreisler mentioned. It was Edward Jenner in 1796 who first introduced the vaccination based on the use of cowpox, a related type of virus, but one that would give immunity, but which wouldn't cause the disease, or only a very minor disease. And he, at that time, showed enormous initiative in getting it round the world as we knew it then. The next slide just shows this is the house in Gloucestershire in the west of England, which Jenner bought when he got married in about 1794. He moved in and lived there for 30 years, and it was from that house that he arranged for cowpox vaccine to be sent into Russia, into America, into Australia, to India, to Africa, all over the world at about 1800 to 1810. from the in a small village in Gloucestershire, which really was quite a tremendous achievement, and of course it achieved considerable success at that time. But the difficulty was, of course, nobody knew how it worked. The understanding of it was unknown. It had simply arisen from the observations, the observation he made, the famous observation that milkmaids who suffered cowpox never suffered from smallpox, and he developed the idea from that point. The understanding of how immunity against infection arose couldn't, of course, come until the basis of infection was understood, due to the great work of Pasteur in Paris and Robert Koch in Berlin. And then it was realized, of course, that first bacteria and then later the viruses were known to be the particles causing the infectious disease. And the understanding, the sort of fundamental step in understanding the molecular basis of immunology was taken in Robert Koch's laboratory in Berlin by Emil Behring about 1890. His experiment was to take the broth of a bacterial culture with either diphtheria or tetanus and inject it into guinea pigs. This next slide, please. Just shows Behring experiment illustrated, a very simple experiment, but he gave the supernatant of the bacterial culture was toxic, poisonous, and was injected in very low doses into a guinea pig so that it didn't kill the animal. If you give a small enough amount, you can inject it without killing it, and then gradually, over the weeks, you can inject larger and larger amounts until the animal becomes immune to big doses and even to infection by the bacteria itself. So he was able to experimentally demonstrate how to make guinea pig immune. But then the important step he took was he took the blood from this immunized guinea pig and he allowed it to clot and took the clear serum and injected it into a second guinea pig and then challenged it with a bacteria and showed that the second guinea pig had now been immune. So he said, therefore, the material which is responsible for immunity is carried in the blood, in the serum, and he called them antibodies. So he defined the material as being material antibodies in the serum, which would give the immunity. And he did the other important experiment, showing that making a guinea pig immune against diphtheria gave no protection against the tetanus bacillus. If the animal had been immunized against diphtheria and then challenged with tetanus, it was killed. So that the immunity is contained in the blood by antibodies, which was only a name at that time, and it's specific. And it is entirely specific, and this is one of the most remarkable features of antibodies, that they are capable of showing a tremendous range of specificity. Millions of different specificities can be shown by any individual animal in there. So that was the basic sort of experiment that from which everything followed. A long period went by before it could be taken much further, but then in the next slide, please, in 1938, in Sweden, in Uppsala, Tiselius took this next experiment where he was taking the proteins from the serum, this is the whole serum, and is fractionated by charge. And so that here is the most acidic, the albumin of the serum proteins, and here is the most basic, and he called them the alpha, beta, and the gamma globulins, and the albumin. And he showed that if he'd immunized a rabbit strongly against any material, pneumococcus or egg albumin, and then he precipitated. He removed the antibody by precipitating it out with the antigen. The antigen is the material injected. Then there was a sharp drop in the content of the gamma globulin. And so that showed that the antibodies were proteins contained in the gamma globulin fraction. Another major advance on the steps there. And it was at that point that that we ourselves came into this to actually isolate and try and characterize and find how it was that the antibody molecule had got this remarkable capacity of showing the specific combining power with the antigen. I should point out that it didn't matter what kind of antibody specificity we're talking about, anti-diphtheria, anti-tetanus, anti-pneumococcal, anti-ovalbumin, anti-anything you like, they're all in this gamma globulin fraction. So the first basic idea was coming through that antibodies are all a very similar structure, but they've got unique features which give them their specific combining power. And in fact, if you take the molecule apart, it was a big molecule, 150,000 in molecular weight, I say, and the difficulty was because it clearly must be complex, and yet you were handling it as a single protein. But with that difficulty, you could show that it was made of four peptide chains whose structure is shown in this next slide. It's four peptide chains, so-called heavy chains, and the two right chains, these singly strings of amino acids joined together by peptide bonds, and the two chains are held together by the disulfide bonds, the heavy to the light and the heavy to the heavy, over the holding as one piece as a molecule. This is the immunoglobulin gamma, as it's so-called. There are other types of immunoglobulin. This is the most common and the most easily understood. And the first point is that it's bivalent. It's a dimer. It's repeating itself twice, and it's got two combining sites, so that when it interacts with anti-N, it cross-links them. Now, the taking apart of the molecule is done by an enzyme, papain, which spits it over here and gives this piece, the so-called FC, fragment crystalline piece over here, and two identical parts, which are the fragment antibody, fragment antigen binding, FAB, Fab fragment. So when it was split by the papain, he gave the two Fab fragments and the FC fragment. And the important point, of course, was that the antigen binding capacity is still in this fragment. It had not been destroyed by splitting the molecule into the three pieces. So and the specific combining power is here, but of course the Fab fragments, they are monovalent, single binding site, and therefore they don't cross-link, they don't cause precipitation of soluble antigens, they don't cause agglutination of bacterial antigens or red cell antigens and so on. So they've got a single combining, each have got a single combining site, and the all antibodies are the same basic structure, but the important point is that the range of specificity is determined by variation in the antibody, in the amino acid sequence at the N-terminal ends of this light chain and the N-terminal end of this heavy chain over here. So that the antibody combining site is determined by the sequence of amino acids in these parts of the molecule. There are 20 different amino acids. The order is important, as well as the nature of the amino acid, so that it's got 20 to the 20th possibilities. Enormous range of different structures can be obtained with that kind of a pattern. It's an incredibly neat way of packaging in one basic structure this very wide range of specific combining power. Now, I mentioned that it was called the FC. That was because when we first did that digestion, we found crystals formed. Now, the whole antibody never crystallizes and never has been crystallized, never can be crystallized, because of the complexity, because it's always a mixture. They're so similar that you can't separate them by any chemical or physical means, so you're always handling a mixture, but this other part crystallized spontaneously. So that was the first indication that this part of the molecule is likely to be identical in all parts of the in all antibody molecules, whereas these are obviously variable. The next slide just shows the crystals, which is the came out nice clean plates of crystals, and the crystal structure has been worked out since. With the FAB part of the molecule, I say, has never been crystallized from normal immunoglobulin. But you do in certain types of cancer. You get a cancer of the cells which are actually making the immunoglobulins, and they, of course, in that case, a single cell divides and grows in, and grows very rapidly, and then you get an identical kind of immunoglobulin antibody molecules are made, and in that case, you can get FAB fragments which are of a single unique specificity and a single unique structure. So you can, in that case, crystallize the FAB as well. The FC is crystallized from normal gamma globulin, because it's identical in all the molecules. Because these molecules can be crystallized, it offered the opportunity for the X-ray crystallographers to actually look at the detailed structure of the molecules and actually build a model of the arrangement of the peptide chains. And this next slide shows the crystal structure on a model obtained in America by of the FAB molecule. Now this is the light this is the heavy chain and this is the light chain in the two different colours, because it's folded in a complex manner, but you can see these two chain structures here. And one point I want to draw attention to is that it's basically in two segments, domains as we call them, two domains. And these where the little labels are this variable part, the N-terminal end of the heavy and the light chain. These are, and they've all been collected together in this part, which is clearly the combining site. This is where the combining site of the antibody with the antigen occurs. And it's these residues, we've got the tags on, the round ones and the square ones, the oblong are in the heavy chain and the round ones are in the light chain. And they both contribute. And because, of course, their arrangement, as well as the actual nature of the amino acid itself, that's why you can get such a tremendous variation over here. So that this is the variable domain, as it's called, and this is the first constant domain of the antibody molecule. And each of the domains appears to have a particular biological structure. In the case of the breaking into the FAB and the FC, you could show that simply as two different, that the combining site was clear here, but it's now with the more detail, you can also break across here, a little more difficulty, but you can do that and find that a specific biological activity is attached with each. But here is the variable domain carrying the antibody combining site. The other part of the molecule, the FC, has also been crystallized, work done by Huber in Munich, and that's shown on the next slide. Where you, a different kind of model, but you can see it's the same thing as the peptide chain again, and these are the two heavy chains. Remember, in the FC, there are two heavy chains joined by a disulfide bond about here. And here, again, you've got a domain structure. This is what we call the second constant domain, and this is the third constant domain. And you can see that the third constant domain, the chains are very closely interacting with each other, as they were in the first and in the variable domain. So these are closely, the peptide chains are closely interlinked here, but in the second constant domain, they're open. There's an open structure, and this dark blue line is the carbohydrate, which is coming in between here. It's the, in that site there. And the joining onto the FAB arms comes over here, with this, over this side there. But nobody has ever been able to crystallize a normal antibody, even though it was coming from a myeloma protein, a cancer protein, and was unique in chemical structure. They still couldn't crystallize the whole molecule. And the only example where crystals of the whole molecule have been obtained are from tumors in which an abnormal, a pathological type of immunoglobulin has been formed, where a part of the hinge region, as we call it, the part joining onto the FAB is missing, it's been deleted out. And in that case, you can get a structure of the whole molecule shown in the next slide. Here, type of thing with a different kind of model again now, with the heavy chain coming over here in that way, and then coming over here and behind in that way, and the light chain and the second light chain over here. And here's the carbohydrate again in this open structure. But you can see still, I hope to just about see the domain structure here of the variable domain, the first constant domain, and then the second constant domain, the open one here, and then the third constant domain down here. And the point appears to be that This would only crystallize in a unique way when this hinge, the part joining the FC part of the molecule onto the two FB molecules, is missing. In the normal way, there are about 20 amino acids in this hinge region, and it gives a flexibility so that you can, the actual FC can swing and can move relative to the FAB. And so it doesn't, in a crystal, it doesn't appear to take up a single unique type of position. And so this is believed to be the reason why you can never get these crystals, even with the homogeneous kind of that. So all we have is the crystal structure of the FAB and the FC, and of this abnormal type of uniglobulin, which gives you a picture as to how the molecule looks, and you can start to think of it in terms of the different biological activities that the antibody molecule shown. I've been stressing all the time, of course, the fact they are divalent and they're able to combine with the antigen. That is the most obvious characteristic, and that, of course, is the way they've been defined and the way they're understood. But there are many other biological activities which are essential in immunity to disease as well. Now, on this next slide, shows just a diagram to make it a little bit simpler what I'm talking about here, of the domain structure, again with the first constant, second constant, and the third constant there, and so on, and the variable domain over there. So that's simply a simple structure of the antibody molecule. Now, the important thing is that the that immunity to infection in the humans is transported from the mother to the fetus via the placenta. So that when a baby is newly born, it is carrying its mother's antibodies and giving it protection against infection, because its own immune system doesn't become effective for about 6 months. And it is striking in a district which is West Africa, where malaria is endemic and is very severe, that babies remain more or less free of malaria for the first 6 months of their lives, and then there's a very heavy death rate between 6 months and 2 years. And it takes the ones, of course, who live beyond 2 years have then developed their immunity, but there's been as much as 30% death rate in that period. But in the first 6 months, they're protected by their mother's antibodies, and the transmission of the antibody molecule from the mother to the fetus depends upon the FC part of the molecule. There are other properties, such as binding onto skin, onto smooth muscle, and so on, but perhaps the most important in defense against infection, which I now want to go and talk about, is that they're responsible for the activation of the complement system. And it seems to be associated specifically with this part of the molecule, the actual initiation of the activation of complement. Now, the existence of a complement system was recognized not long after Behring had made his first discovery of antibodies. Behring, you remember, working in Robert Koch's laboratory, and the discovery of complement was made by Bordet, a Belgian, working in Pasteur's laboratory in Paris. Now, the next slide, please. This just shows how antibodies work on their own. That they are bivalent, as I've been stressing, and so they agglutinate or stick together. This is an example of virus particles, different kinds of antigenic components on the surface, antibodies of different specificities indicated by the different type of combining site here, but they're all sticking together and agglutinating these virus particles. The same thing happens with bacterial particles, and if it's a soluble antigen, then the same thing happens with the cross-linking, and then it precipitates out as aggregates. But the Bordet showed that this in itself was not enough. It would it, it, It would not destroy the bacteria that was involved. The next slide, please. Here was the experiment he did. He took immune serum. It was only 6 years after the after Behring, and in the and he showed that in vitro, in the test tube, as well as in the whole animal, if it came from a rabbit that had been immunized with cholera vibrio, and you added the bacteria, the cholera, to the antiserum, it would be agglutinated, it would stick together, and it would lyse, it would be killed. There'd be holes would be made in the bacterial cell wall. But if you heated it, in his first experiment, he simply left his antiserum on the bench in the laboratory for 2 or 3 weeks and found it lost the ability to kill. He then heated it gently at about 60 degrees for half an hour and showed that it had lost its ability to kill. It would not lyse the cells, but it would still agglutinate and stick them together. And he then took these agglutinated cells and he added to it fresh serum from an animal that had not been immunized. So there's no specificity, no immunity, but it was fresh serum, had not been heated, and then the agglutinated cells would lyse. And he drew the conclusion that there must be two factors. There must be the antibody that Behring had discovered that was relatively stable to heat, survived this and was responsible for the agglutination, and that there was a second main component which caused the lysis of the cell and the killing of it. And he showed, in this case, that if you took the agglutinated cholera and grew it in a broth, it would grow out and would be just as lethal as it was before. So the antibody alone is ineffective, but it's where the specificity lies. The antibody is specific, and then it initiated the complement activation, which causes the lysis of the cell if the antigen is a cell on that. But there is also another aspect to it. It's been realized more recently that, in fact, the forming of aggregates and agglutinates isn't, in the absence of complement, is not only ineffective in killing the bacteria, but it also is dangerous in itself. That the aggregates will, in fact, become localized at the basal membranes and will cause a disease in their own right. So you're doing more harm than good by causing agglutination or aggregation with antibodies in the absence of complement. And there are rare cases, fortunately rare cases, where a person has inherited a deficiency of a component of the complement system, and you get these so-called immune complex diseases. On this next slide shows an example of this is just showing the effect of lysis on a different bacteria, where you can see that the activation of the complement system actually causes these, they're not really holes, but they're weaknesses in the membrane, and that of course is what kills the actual bacterial cell in the same way. So the complement is causing lysis if it's a cell, and the other aspect of it is causing the phagocytosis, the uptake of the aggregates and agglutinates by these macrophages and removing them from the system. And in the next slide, please. This just shows it's a boy in Birmingham who is deficient in one of the early components of complement. And you can see that you get this inflammation, typical across the face and on the hands and on other parts of the body, and it's where he can't get rid, his macrophages can't take up the aggregates and remove them, and they collect on the basal membrane and cause inflammation, as you can see there. And while that in itself is not of great danger, the greatest risk is that they will be localized, these immune complexes will be localized in the kidney where they can cause damage which could become lethal. So the complement system is essential for killing bacteria and viruses, and it's essential for the removal through the stimulation of phagocytosis of the aggregates and complexes formed on that. Now, it's a very rare type of disease, because it's very difficult to handle or do anything about it. Because when it occurs, it is really quite informative as to how things are happening. If one of the major components, or the third component of complement, is missing, then it looks as if the patient gets repeated infection from childhood, and it looks in many ways like the A gamma globulinemic, a patient who can't make antibodies. They, of course, occur rarely, and in that case, they are subjected to repeated infections, and prior to antibiotics, of course, they died very early. So the complete absence of the complement system is just as totally dangerous in terms of infection as the absence of the antibodies. Now, I'd just like to tell you again a little bit more about the structure of some of the complement molecules. It's a complicated system, can't give any attempt any full picture, but just take an illustration of the early components and show how working out the structure of the molecules has given some idea as to how the system works, and therefore has given us some idea as how to stimulate it or suppress it. It can cause damage, it can help. So it can do either of two things. In the autoimmune diseases of the arthritic type and this kind of thing, then if the complement is causing damage, it is not causing any protection. So there are cases where you want to stimulate it, and cases where you want to suppress it. But I have the next slide, please. Now, this just illustrates the beginning of the method of the way the complement is activated. And it depends primarily on the interaction of the antibody with the antigen. The nature of the antigen, as I've been stressing, can be anything. It can be soluble carbohydrate, soluble protein, it can be particles, it can be any kind of infectious particle, and so on. So the nature of the antigen is not important. The point is that the antibody cross-links and forms the aggregates. And though it's not entirely clear, the key step appears to be the bringing together of many antibody molecules so that the Fc molecules are in close proximity to each other. It's the bringing together of many of the parts of the Fc, because I told you that it was the second constant domain in the Fc which is responsible for the first initiation step of the complement system. And it's got two pathways of activation. The major one is the one activated here, which we call the classical pathway, because it was discovered first. So that I'm just talking about the beginning of the major pathway. And it is complicated. There are about 20 proteins involved. As I say, I shan't attempt to explain the whole thing to you. But the first component of complement is, in fact, a complex of three proteins, C1Q, C1R, C1S. And they bind onto the antibody-antigen aggregates. They don't, of course, interact with the monomer antibody. The antibody goes circulating in the blood, and there's no interaction. It's the aggregation of the antibody, bringing the Fcs together, which causes this binding and then activation of the first component of complement. And the basic feature is that that you then change these zymogens, proenzymes, into active proteolytic enzymes, into enzymes that will activate each other by cutting peptide bonds in the proteins, coming down in a cascade or sequential type of interaction. And so the C1R and the C1S, they become active proteinases, and they then split the fourth and the second component, which then combine together in this way here, and the C2 again is a protease, and this enzyme then splits the third component, which then joins on. The active enzyme is a C2 still here, and that activates this fifth component. So that it's a complicated picture where some proteins are active enzymes and some are acting as links. And the important point is that it is bound onto the antibody-antigen aggregates. And in each case, there seems to be a sort of linking protein binding onto the proteolytic zymogen, which becomes the next active protease. And it's the C1q which binds onto the antibody-antigen aggregates. And that boy whose picture I showed you, he was deficient in C1q. And that was why he couldn't get rid of these aggregates. It's a C1q that binds, and then the R binds onto the Q, and the S binds onto the R. And the first step, which is always the hardest to solve, is the activation of the C1R. That is a zymogen, and it is spontaneously activated when this complex associates with itself here. And then when that happens, then the R activates the S activates the 4 and the 2, they form this complex, and again they are bound onto the aggregates. At stress this point, the 4 forms active covalent bond with the antibody. And the whole thing is happening, and this essential part, of course, as I stress, with all these things, if it goes wrong, it causes damage. These are active proteases, and you can activate the whole complement system, and you can, of course, end up lysing the animal's own cells, causing damage to their own tissues, and this certainly is one of the factors in tissue damage in the autoimmune diseases. So that they are actually bound on, and of course this localizes them. It means that they're not going, they're not being dispersed around, they're actually bound onto the antibody-antigen aggregates. The 4 binds and the Q binds, the RS onto the Q and the 2 onto the 4 and the 3 onto the 4 again. So that you've got a sort of link protein holding a zymogen which is then activated, which then activates other proteins on that. And they turn out to have very unusual features. In fact, several of these proteins are so unexpected in their structure that you almost feel there must have been some independent evolutionary pathway that brought them about. And the first one was the C1q, which caused so much surprise when the structure was worked out by Ken Reed at Oxford. Because it turned out it's a large protein, more than 400,000 in molecular weight, and it's half of collagen-type structure. The next slide just illustrates what I mean by a collagen structure. Collagen, I'm sure you all know, of course, is the main structural protein which holds a skeleton together. And it's evolved to give strength and resilience in holding the bones to bone and so on. And its structure has got this very unique feature of having a repeating 1,000 residues with going glycine, XY, glycine, every third residue. And these uncommon amino acids, the hydroxy amino acids, hydroxylysine and hydroxyproline. And there can be 1,000 or more residues of this repeating type of sequence, which gives the basic structure of collagen. And each of it's a three peptide chains, and each of them have got this so-called minor helix. And in the collagen itself, in the molecule collagen, there are three peptide chains interlinked to give a major helix of that type there. And it is this special structure that gives it its strength and its resilience, and it's evolved for that. What is surprising to find, the first time, that a soluble molecule, which has got a clear-cut biological function with specificity and interaction, should have half its structure of this collagen type. Why that should be, we still don't know. But it's clear, and you can easily, when working out the structure, prove that it's collagen type, because, of course, the sequence shows it's very specific type of interaction. There's a special carbohydrate, a disaccharide, often on the hydroxylysine, glycosyl galactose and so on. And of course there's a special enzyme, collagenase, which will break down that type of peptide chain, but it won't break down ordinary globular molecules. But anyway, when the structure of C1Q was worked out, I say by Reed, his next program, the next slide, just shows you the kind of thing he found. It's made of 18 peptide chains. 18 peptide chains of about 22 or 3,000 in molecular weight. And each peptide chain has got this structure of being about half collagen, not quite a half, but a third to a half of a collagen structure, and then what you might say a more normal globular type of amino acid sequence on there. And with there being 18 peptide chains, and knowing that there was this collagen type structure, the first guess was that in fact there would be six threes, because we knew collagen existed as a trimer. But in fact, when the disulfide bonds were worked out, it wasn't quite so easy, because the A and B chains were linked by disulfide bond, but the C and the C chains were linked to each other by disulfide bonds. So it didn't fall into threes as we were expecting it to. These chains, of course, are all a little bit different, the A, B and the C, but they have the same basic point of the collagen and the globular structure. And it seems clear now that they must associate, like as we show them here, with these forming a triple helix, as in collagen, with the interaction here being mainly non-covalent, and then because of the disulfide bond there, it means that they're occurring in pairs, and so that six of the peptide chains are giving this type of a structure, with the collagen as used here. I draw attention to the fact that it bends. Now, collagen never bends in that sort of way, but I said that the collagen has this XY gly, going right the way across. In the case of the collagen, there's a break in the middle. In one case, it's XY alanine, XY gly. In another case, there's an extra threonine put in. And in another case, there's a whole tripeptide inserted. So we knew from the chemistry there must be a break. It couldn't be a straight line, a straight thing. And a sort of break here is what was suggested by it. But this is only six of the 18 peptide chains, so the whole molecule is shown on this next slide. Next slide, please. Here it is, these three pairs are joined together, and it gives you this peculiar, what we call the bunch of tulips structure, where the stems of the tulips are the collagen, like fibrils, and the heads of the tulips are these globular heads, as you can see there. And it was encouraging to believe that this was correct, because measurements of the structure of collagen are very well known. You know the number of amino acid tripeptides occurring, the exact dimensions are known, and if you calculate what you'd expect and you measure directly on the electron microscope what you see, you get a very close agreement on this there. So the Q has this quite unique structure. There's no other protein like it. Why it should need collagen fibrils, we've got no idea. But it clearly is in the interacting with the antibody molecule, these heads are the ones that interact. You remember I said that the Fc molecules are being bunched together, and in the tulip heads you can show are the part of the molecule that actually interacts with the antibody molecule. You can break it into pieces. Rather, if we did with antibody molecules, you can use collagenase and destroy that part of the molecule and leave the heads and show that they still bind. And you can use pepsin and destroy the heads and leave the fibrous structures and show that the R and the S interact with the fibrous structures. So you can break down and work out the biological activities of the molecule in that way on that. Now, when the electron microscopists began looking at the C1Q, it was clear that it has got this type of structure that the chemistry is suggesting. The next slide, please. Next slide. I think you can see that on this field, pictures taken in Basel, Switzerland, you've got this bunch of tulip structure. It's a quite unique structure. No other protein molecule has got features like that. But it clearly fits with the chemistry very well indeed. And I say these are the collagenous fibres which join together with a bend about the middle of the place about there. Now the interaction I say is through the heads, and I have a diagram on the next slide to just show how we believe that the Q interacts. Here is what is meant to be a cell membrane with the lipid, the fatty acid side chains coming through here in this double structure shown, that is the now good evidence that membranes have this, and these peculiar things are the protein molecules, some of which are sticking right through the molecule, both sides, some only on one side and some on the other, and of course it's these protein molecules sticking on the outer side of the membrane which are the antigens. When you inject a cell, it's these molecules, or perhaps polysaccharide which is attached to these molecules, which are the antigens, and which the antibody forms the covalent bonds, is made against it, you see. And you can see these are meant to be the antibody molecules with the domain structure, with the variable domain, the combining site, first constant domain, the open second constant domain, and then the third constant domain here. And the interaction of the Q is with this part of the molecule. You can show that by taking the antibody molecule to pieces, as was done originally, but in a slightly different way. And it's just interesting to notice the size of the C1Q relative to the antibody. It's a massive, it's 400,000 in size, and these, of course, are only 150,000 broken down into pieces of about 50,000. So you get that kind of a picture of the interaction on there. And then you build on the C1R and the C1S, and the electron microscopists, again at Basel, Ingalls, and in Los Angeles, have shown that the R and the S, the first two proteins evolved, seem to be sort of bead-like structures running around this collagenous part of the molecules. That, of course, had been shown by the breaking down of the C1Q, it was there, and again, the electron microscopy agrees with this and shows, in fact, it's in this branching part of the peptide chains that they occur. So my last slide just sort of summarizes the thing on the next slide, please. Just summarizes the picture. It's not to scale, as you can see, but the basic idea of the molecular basis of infection is you've got these cell membrane here with the antigenic sites on it, the antibody molecule with its domain structure, the antibody combining sites coming onto the antigenic sites here, which I say can be either protein or carbohydrate and on protein there, and you must get several molecules of antibody. Only two are shown in this case because it gets too complicated, but it's clear that you must have many. And in fact, the C1Q under optimal conditions can combine with 12 antibody molecules. So it's capable, each of the heads is capable of interacting with two parts of the antibody molecule. It's the second constant domain which is involved, and it's indicating the open structure here on there. There's been argument, of course, as to whether there's a conformational change here when the antibody site binds, because obviously DEF-AB arms are, I mentioned, are flexible, and it could be that there's some allosteric change occurring over here. And there was some support for that in that if you break that disulfide bond, then you lose most of the complement activating activity. But though it's not clear, it seems to be more likely that it's the multiple interactions. The Q is rigid, as I mentioned, with the cognin is rigid, and the interaction is due to the flexibility of the antibody, of the FC part of the molecule, the swinging around on there. So it's multiple interactions of the Q onto that second constant domain. And then you've got this, and it's much too
too small, as I was painting it. It's a bigger molecule than is shown there. And then these first molecules here are actually interlinked around in that way, if we can believe the electron microscopy pictures. And the combination activates this first component into a protease, presumably by a change of steric structure. When that's once achieved, then it activates the second, C1s bar here. And the second and the fourth components of complement, they, of course, are in the serum here, and they are activated by the S bar. And what the, again, is a very remarkable feature is that the C4 then forms a covalent bond with the FAB part of the molecule. We're not quite sure which, but we think it's over here. And it forms a covalent bond, which is, to any protein chemist, any biochemist, is a very remarkable thing. It's got a structure inside which appears to be unique to the C4, or at least it's common to C4 and C3 three molecules and one or two other more rare ones. But this binds in here, and then the second component also activates, binds onto the C4, that activates C3, and you go down the pathway until you activate what we call the last five components, and they're the ones which are responsible for lysis if the antigen is a cell. Because it doesn't need to be. That lytic part is important in killing cells, but it is also, as I stressed earlier, that the whole complement system is essential for the removal of the aggregates by the phagocytic cells on that. So that while there's a long way to go, we have got a reasonable idea as to how these biological activities are occurring in terms of the structure of the molecule, and because it gives you the opportunity to think intelligently about, I say, how to stimulate or how to inhibit these things. Because although they are normally of great benefit to the animal, they can, when they go wrong, they can also cause great damage. Thank you very much.